If you're looking for a car to buy that is easy on the earth, you have lots of choices now. From fuel-efficient gas-only cars to gas-electric hybrids to fully electric cars, there are many models out there now. But a recent study shows that people who buy one very efficient car in a two-car household often have another car that is far less fuel-efficient. So think of the bumper sticker, "My other car is a blank." If the sticker's on an electric, there's a good chance the blank will be an SUV and vice versa. We can get into the reasons now with one of the authors of that study. Results are in a working paper from the University of California, Davis Energy Economics Program called Attribute Substitution in Household Vehicle Portfolios. It's the work of James Archsmith, Kenneth Gillingham, Christopher Knittle, and David Rapson. David Rapson is the economics professor who's our guest today on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Nice to be here.
It sounds a bit more like psychology than economics at the outset, but to explain the concept of attribute substitution.
Well, the idea is that people have a lot of different transportation needs and that they might value different things about different cars. So if you end up increasing the fuel economy of one of the cars that a household owns, that might be linked with some other attributes, like it might be smaller, it might be less powerful, maybe less comfortable. And that could lead them in their subsequent car purchases to buy a next car that's actually maybe more powerful or larger and more comfortable. And that can have implications for, you know, the gasoline savings that could come from making the first car more efficient.
And this is not just a thing with cars, I understand. Attribute substitution happens in a bunch of other products around the house?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about the decisions you make over time in the household, think even about the decorations you have around your house. You might have a blue carpet, and that might cause you to, you know, change the color of your curtains, or you might have one college degree in a certain major, and that might lead you to kind of change the choice of what you take next in a postgraduate degree. So there are lots of things that we do that are linked over time.
What about things like household purchases, stuff like television sets? I mean, there's some pretty clear, consistent examples of ways in which people buy those products.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, one of the areas actually that where there's some really interesting evidence is in our preferences for having diversity in the gender of our children. Actually, that if families have two children of the same gender, they're more likely to have a third. Presumably because they prefer diversity in the genders. And I think you can see this across many different household decisions, and perhaps televisions are one of them. If you buy a large television for one room, you know, maybe you don't need quite as large a television for the other room.
Wow, but it even gets into things as non-consumer as how many kids we're going to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, that's amazing. So now on to cars, though. You say in this paper that you have a rich data set. Where did all the data come from?
Well, the data comes from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and we have a data set that essentially has...
California DMV.
Yes, exactly, the California DMV. And we see households and their vehicle purchases over time. Now, we don't actually know the identities of the households, but we see them over several years, and we can observe every car that they purchase and every car that they sell.
So it's identified by address? This is how you know you're working with the same household?
Much of this work was done under a research contract with the California Air Resources Board, and they were the ones who actually created the household element of the data set. But yeah, essentially you can look at names and addresses over time, and you can create households from those variables. But those were things that we didn't see as researchers. Those are obviously sensitive, and so the ARB actually was the one that created the household variable.
Okay, so that information was more or less off limits to you, but you were able to at least extrapolate. You were talking about the same households. These two cars belong in this household, that sort of thing.
That's exactly right.
So I'm thinking, though, that just particularly in a state as huge and diverse as California, there must be a lot of... a lot of variability based on how many people in the household, how far and where they travel on a regular basis, and stuff like that.
There is a lot of variability in the cars that households own. You have some households that may have a couple, you know, fuel-intense cars, what we call gas guzzlers. You may have households that have two very fuel-efficient cars, and then everything in between. So really, yes, there's a lot of variability, and that both creates opportunities and challenges in terms of analyzing the data.
David Rapson, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an economics professor at the University of California, Davis, one of four who wrote up attribute substitution in household vehicle portfolios. It's a working paper that indicates that if you've got two cars in the garage, there's a good chance that if one's fuel efficient, the other's probably a lot less so. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about the implications here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, I mean, is this a fairly common thing then if there were two cars in the household that car one and car two were very different?
Well, actually, I mean, yes, that is certainly a thing, but in our study, we're not so much looking at the number of households that have cars with different attributes. We're kind of running a thought experiment here. So imagine that you could make one of the cars in the household a little bit more efficient. Of course, this is a little bit of a hypothetical, but it's the type of thing that's interesting to researchers because it allows us to then ask the question, well, what might we expect to be the effects of policies that do something like that cause households to have a little bit more fuel-efficient cars? Might that cause them to exhibit different behavior down the road? And that's exactly what our study examines. And the results are relevant to major policies that affect our everyday lives, like fuel economy standards.
So is there some perception that there's a backfiring of policy here?
Well, I'm not sure I would use the word backfire, but certainly the effect that we find is large and quite a bit larger, frankly, than I was expecting. And yes, it's operating in the direction of undermining the goals of fuel economy standards. So if you're hoping, as a policymaker, to implement fuel economy standards with the goal of reducing gasoline demand, then when households then subsequently go and they buy a more fuel-intense car later on, that's going to undermine the effects of the program.
So are you suggesting that it's possible that by insisting on better fuel economy for cars that we end up driving people into the arms of SUVs?
Well, a little bit, yeah. I'm not going to say that it completely reverses the benefits of the policy, but it certainly seems that the amount of gasoline conservation that we're going to enjoy from that policy is a lot lower than people think. And if you're concerned about things like climate change, then I think this result is very concerning. And also, if you're just someone who wants to make your own choices, this is a costly policy for people who really need to have, say, a large car. They're living in a rural area up in the mountains. Maybe they need an SUV.
So I wonder if David, you guys came up with a sort of a typical two-car household, and within that two-car household, what the typical cars were, even if it's just by, what the MPG was for car one and car two.
No, there's no such thing as a typical household. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, it does just span the gamut. You have lots of diversity in the cars that households own in this state.
All right, so it's not as simple as to say that if you own a Miata or a Leaf, you're also going to own an SUV as well.
No, it's not as simple as that. And, what's interesting is the effect that we see here is an average effect across all of these different types of households. So you could be looking at a two-car household with two fuel-efficient cars, and if you make one of them a little bit more efficient, the likelihood is the next car that they buy is going to be less efficient. And that's also true if they have two gas guzzlers or if they have a fuel-efficient car and a gas guzzler to start out with. On average, these effects are very large.
I wonder, and here again, I know I'm starting to stray into psychology and off the economics bandwidth here, but if there was anything in your study that indicated how much of this was perception versus reality? If people just assume that a car that has better MPGs is quote-unquote gutless or at least has less horsepower than one that has fewer MPGs?
That's a really good question, and we can't actually test that directly in this study. All we really get to is the effect itself. But the mechanism for that effect, I think, is left a little bit to future work and maybe our imagination. I mean, it could be anything from people kind of experience a feeling of like warm glow from having a fuel-efficient car, and that makes them feel like, oh, well, the next time I can maybe indulge in something a little bit more comfortable and powerful, That's potentially one mechanism, but it could also just be that, you know, people really like the attributes associated with an SUV, and they need it to, you know, take their kids to soccer practice, to haul around whatever they need to haul around, to be safe on, you know, on slippery roads in the winter. So there are lots of reasons why people might think of their vehicle portfolio as linked.
All right, so not much to go on other than the data. I mean, you can't really get into what the motivations were up close, because you just have the indications of what the results were. But let me ask this question, David. I mean, how elastic did you find demand to be? I mean, given pressures from outside features, things that are not, that don't actually come with the car, like the cost of gasoline.
Well, we did find that the gasoline affects the demand for fuel economy. And in fact, one of my co-authors in this study, Chris Knittel, has written another paper that looks at that directly. And we really see that consumers are responding to the price of gasoline in terms of the cars that they buy. So when the price of gasoline was really high in 2007, you know, people were buying a lot of fuel-efficient cars. And when the price dropped down, people started buying SUVs again. So this this idea that I think is one of the motivations actually for implementing fuel economy standards in the first place, that consumers are not really paying attention to the future gas costs of their vehicles, that's just not really what we see in the empirical evidence. We see that people actually are really quite rational when it comes to gasoline prices and the expense of driving that they're going to incur based on the car that they buy.
We're talking about two-car families and the kinds of car portfolios they have, where if there's one very fuel-efficient vehicle, the other one is probably a lot less so. This is a finding of a team of economists out of the University of California Davis Energy Economics Program. One of the four authors, David Rapson, is with us on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can continue the conversation with us, 800-838-3760, to join by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and David Rapson.
Hi. Well, as a person who went from owning a car that got 50 miles to a gallon to buying a Nissan Leaf, I guess I don't fit the mold, but I think what we really need to do is tax what we don't want, right? So if we increase the gas tax to include all the externalities of fossil fuels, you know, mining, all the degradation they do, it really would be unaffordable for most people to drive gas-powered vehicles, especially the gas guzzlers. And also, I think it's our culture, too. Our culture needs to make it cool to drive or take drive cars that are fuel efficient or electric, or take mass transit, ride bikes, et cetera, because the consumption culture that we currently have is, you know, taking us down the path of where we won't have a habitable planet in the next 20, 30, 40 years. So I just think, you know, keep in mind that we should be taxing what we don't want, which is more and more use of fossil fuels, and giving incentives for people to drive their either electric cars or take mass transit. And I basically drive my Nissan Leaf. I live 20 miles out of town. I drive it 99.9% of the time. And then when we do need to go out of town, the area, there's no charging, we take my husband's Subaru. And we also use that for going up in the mountains because it's a four-wheel drive. But for 99.9% of my trips, I take the Nissan, and I'm proud as punch to be driving that, and especially when I can plug it into a solar array in town to charge it with. So I just think that it's a two-pronged thing that the culture needs. We need to start encouraging people to be environmentally aware, because our government leaders, especially at the federal level, aren't helping in any way. But those are my comments, and
all right.
Thanks.
Thank you, Pam. Appreciate that. So, David, some thoughts from you?
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more with everything that Pam said. I mean, it sounds like she's taken all of my economics classes. I mean, you know, one of the things that she said, I just really want to highlight this because it's so important in terms of finding a solution to this very difficult problem of climate change, which is we know that when you put a price onto something that's bad, people consume less of it. And the beautiful thing about that, in this case, let's talk about a price on carbon, right, which could either be a carbon tax or from the cap and trade that is already in place here in California. You know, when you implement a policy like that, it creates incentives on many margins that lead to less gasoline being consumed and burned, right, and less damage to the planet. And that's really what we want. We want an incentive on every margin that's operating in the right direction. And one of the problems with fuel economy standards is that we've seen several examples of the way that they create incentives that actually undermine the policy itself. In this paper that we're talking about today, Jeff, that we just have documented one of those types of policies, or one of those types of channels that undermine the policy. But there are many other that have been documented already. And so Pam is right on. I think we need to increase the price of burning dirty fuels.
Which brings up the term Pigouvian gasoline taxes. It appears in the working paper a lot. What does that mean?
Well, the Pigouvian tax is exactly what Pam is suggesting. It's a tax that that corrects for the marginal damages associated with doing something bad.
So the externalities, the stuff that isn't included in the price, like the having to dig things out of the ocean and spills and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, the reason why it works is because if you increase the price of something that is creating damage, then less of that damage is going to be created, and that's good for the world. So, you know, we have this idea that tax is a bad word, but actually in the case of things like pollution or externalities, it's actually a very good thing and very efficient.
Yeah, I have to wonder. I think it was, I can't remember the New York Times columnist now. Tom, he suggested that that gas should never go below $4 a gallon. And it seems to have been the magic number at which people just before the Great Recession realized that public transportation was a good thing. Because when gas hit $4 a gallon, behavior changed a lot. I think you mentioned that as well. Do you think in terms of anything like that as you work out potential future approaches to gas taxes?
Well, my own personal belief is that we really do need to raise the price of gasoline, yes. And, you know, I'm not sure that I really think we should set a price floor at $4 because that, you know, is significantly higher than the current price and probably more so than the combined damage created by burning gasoline. So that might not necessarily be exactly the right price. But, yeah, in general, I completely agree with that sentiment that we need to be looking at ways to increase the gasoline price so that we're not emitting so much carbon dioxide.
I want to come back again to the example about increasing fuel efficiency. As cars get more fuel efficient, that the policy might be working against it. I mean, are people turned off then by cars that have high fuel mileage because they think they are not very powerful or something?
Well, no. What I'm really talking about there is a few different things. So the first thing that we ought to be really concerned about is that fuel economy standards are putting people into cars with attributes that they don't particularly value, right? Those are not cars that they would have bought in the absence of the policy, right? So we're kind of making them drive smaller cars that have different attributes. So you know, you can put a dollar value on that. But another cost is that when you put somebody into a more fuel-efficient car, the cost to them of going a mile in that car is lower. And what happens when you reduce the price of something? People do it more. So we actually see in our paper and in a large literature on what's called the rebound effect that fuel efficiency leads to people driving more. And of course, you know, the goal of nobody cares about fuel efficiency inherently, right? The reason why we are trying to manipulate fuel efficiency is because we care about gasoline usage. And the rebound effect is going to lead people to burn more gasoline. There's another effect that is a little bit, it's very intuitive once you hear about it, but it's kind of surprising, which is that when you implement fuel economy standards, you're basically disallowing certain gas guzzlers from being sold in the market. You're making gas guzzlers scarce in the new car market. Well, one of the effects of that is used gas guzzlers become more valuable, right? They're scarce in the market. Their value goes up, and they end up sticking around the vehicle fleet a lot longer. You know, we don't want that to happen. If we're concerned about climate change, we want those gas guzzlers to be retired. So there are lots of things in addition to the attribute substitution that we document in this study that should lead us to be concerned about fuel economy standards if what we care about is climate change abatement.
Wow, a whole lot of different variables to think about for certain. Mm-hmm. Here's a call from Phil in Eureka. We're talking to David Rapson, the economist at the University of California, Davis. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Yes, I had a conversation with a fellow a while back. This was just in passing. And apparently he was telling me that the federal government, via the military, is the largest polluter in this country. in terms of their lack of fuel efficiency and all the equipment that they operate, especially the military. Huh. I was wondering what you know about that.
Beyond the bounds of what I know, David Rapson, is that something in your wheelhouse?
Well, I can't speak to that actually directly, but I will say that, you know, the government sector is huge in the economy, and I would not be surprised if the activities of the government lead to a lot of burning of fuel. So it wouldn't surprise me if what Phil says is true.
So back to the period of the data set you got from the California DMV, what was the ending year, and what were the years involved?
So we're looking at 2001 through 2007. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit old. We've been working on this study for quite a long time, and there are a couple reasons why we chose that period. But yes, it's 2001 to 2007.
All right, so that raises the question. And since the period of your data set, many more electric cars have come onto the market, and I wondered if at the end of that time period, if you noticed more effects with the electrics on the market.
Well, we don't look at that in this study, but actually, that's one of the major areas that I'm researching right now is the effect of electric vehicles, demand for electric vehicles, the effect of subsidies that are promoting the purchase of electric vehicles. And so, yeah, I think that's a really important factor that we don't look at in this study, but we're examining now.
I was going to ask about subsidies and tax credits. So those are not really factored into what you did here?
No, they're not.
Okay. It's a really interesting look at things, though. The idea that if you have one fuel-efficient car, your next one is probably going to be a lot less fuel-efficient gets back to the issue of attribute substitution. And the working paper is called Attribute Substitution in Household Vehicle Portfolios. David Rapson, one of the four authors, along with James Archsmith, Kenneth Gillingham, and Christopher Knittle, all at the University of California Davis Energy Economics Program. Really informative stuff. David, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.